After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Caitlin Dickerson. This is The Daily. Today, the secret is out. The Senate unveils its healthcare bill. And after all the waiting, what was promised to be a dramatic revamp of the House bill looks a lot like the House bill. And part two in our coverage of the opioid crisis. A single first-class envelope arrives from overseas with enough fentanyl to get almost 50,000 people high. It's Friday, June 23rd.
Senate Press.
Hi, I'm calling for Jennifer Steinhauer.
Hold on just a minute.
So much buildup.
Hi.
Jennifer.
Hi.
This is Caitlin Dickerson.
Hey.
And I know you only have a few minutes, but I have to just take a moment to note, I mean, this is the fact that I get to speak with Jennifer Steinhauer in the phone booth is really a career peak for me. This is huge.
Likewise.
I talked to Jennifer on Thursday afternoon. So, Jennifer, the Senate released today their healthcare bill. It was crafted in secret. We've been talking about it for weeks. We had no idea what was in it. So does this feel like Christmas morning to you a little bit?
Well, I wouldn't say Christmas morning. It feels a little bit more like a New Year's Eve I once spent on Capitol Hill while they tried to pass a bunch of bills to keep the government open. That was a splendid memory that tattooed on my brain forever. But
okay.
Actually, what's interesting about this is how much of it is sort of not been done, right? For example, the Republican leaders on Capitol Hill showed the language, the substance of their draft to people at the White House, and as we understand it, to some healthcare lobbyists before they shared it with their own Republican conference. That's somewhat remarkable, and basically released it to the public almost simultaneously. And then how they're going about it procedurally, you know, a lot of this is sort of uncharted territory. I've been asking people, for example, if the healthcare bill fails, can they jump right on to tax reform without having to pass a whole new budget, which will be its own mess?
Mm-hmm.
People don't actually even know. I've gotten all these different answers. So they're kind of just sort of, you know, uncharted waters. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's just sort of not been seen.
So before we get ahead of ourselves, it sounds like there are a lot of questions moving forward. Let's talk about the bill itself. What is in this bill?
So Claire McCaskill, who's a Democrat from Missouri, just said, you know, this bill is the House bill. It's the same stew. It's a different recipe. And that is somewhat true. I mean, there are a lot of details that do differ, but it does maintain in its structure a lot that is similar to the House bill. I would argue it's a bit more moderate. It gives more financial assistance to lower income people, although middle income old people who do not yet qualify for Medicare are still pretty hammered. Does repeal all the tax increases imposed by the Affordable Care Act, which is basically a tax cut, right? It's a tax cut for the affluent. So we'll see in debate what this final version looks like, but that's a little bit of a sneak preview.
And are there any big surprises in this bill for you?
Are there any big surprises? I guess I thought, you know, Lamar Alexander, senator from Tennessee, who's been very involved in health care for years, made a big point after the House passed their bill that the Senate was going to really go its own way. And so I thought maybe they would come up with clever, different types of fixes. And in the end, I guess I'm surprised that it kept so closely to the House bill. But then again, you know, they may see that as the way to get the majority of Republicans in this chamber to go along.
I mean, that was going to be my next question, is how can we be having this discussion about a bill that so closely resembles what the House passed when
I don't see any way that it goes back in the form that it comes.
All we've heard from the beginning, as soon as the House passed a bill, was that there was no way the Senate bill could look anything like it.
I just know that over here, people want to make sure that it's something that's going to work for the American people.
And that if it did look anything like it, that there's no way such a Senate bill would ever pass.
Well, it's true. They have tweaked it in some ways to bring on board the You know, we refer to them as moderate senators. I have a different thing that I would call them. I would call them expansion state senators. Those are states that need more Medicaid. Those are states that have high opioid incidence. Those are states with high costs because in rural areas you have less health care, so it costs people more money to access health care. So these are issues in states like Maine and Alaska. They were all concerned about the House bill. I think some of their concerns have been addressed. So threading that needle where you address the concerns of the House bill with the more moderate or expansion state senators and keep some of your folks farther to the right on board, that's a pretty tough job.
And then what happens, Jennifer, moving forward politically? And can you remind us how many Republicans have to vote for this bill in order for it to pass?
So it needs 51 votes. However, Mike Pence can cast a vote, and they expect that he will have to. So he can only afford to lose two of his 53 Republican members.
Okay.
And we are assuming, and I'm sure correctly, that not a single Democrat or independent will vote for the bill. So it's got to be done with Republicans.
Right.
They will go next week if, according to Mitch McConnell's plan, members will go home this weekend. They will come back next week, and they will vote on the plan. Now, when they vote on it, they have something called a Votorama.
That's the actual name, Votorama?
Yes, Votorama. First, they have 20 hours of debate. Ostensibly, both sides can offer as many amendments as they want. Now, Mitch McConnell has methods at his disposal to limit the amendments, but basically, you vote all night long. And we will see if they get it passed. Look, the bill, as in its draft form released on Thursday morning, that particular version of the bill, if you're listening to senators and taking them at their word, that bill cannot pass.
We already know that.
Yes, because we have enough senators speaking negatively about it.
And who has come out and said they won't vote for it?
Well, no one said the words, I won't vote for this.
Okay.
But
we are not fixing Obamacare. The problems of Obamacare will remain and may get worse.
Senator Rand Paul, Senator Mike Lee, Senator Ted Cruz, Senator Ron Johnson have all said they can't support the bill in its current form.
Okay.
This current draft doesn't get the job done.
Which basically means we want to amend it. So if you took the bill as is right now and put it on the floor in an hour, I do not believe that it would pass. Can it be amended? Can members cajole other members as they go along? That remains to be seen. That's obviously Mitch McConnell's hope and plan. But this is one of those things that we just can't say on Thursday, the day that bill is released, hey, there's so much enthusiasm, they're going to take this thing over the line. That's just not possible.
All right, Jennifer, we'll let you get back to writing.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. On Thursday afternoon, President Obama responded to the bill, which is yet another step toward the dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, his most significant legislative victory. On Facebook, he wrote, "The Senate bill released Thursday is not a healthcare bill. It's a massive transfer of wealth from middle class and poor families to the richest people in America. Simply put, if there's a chance you might get sick, get old, or start a family, this bill will do you harm. And small tweaks over the course of the next couple weeks, under the guise of making these bills easier to stomach, cannot change the fundamental meanness at the core of this legislation." We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
It's almost a sign of relief to find just heroin or just cocaine or just crack. And then that's sad to say, you know?
Yesterday, Chris Green, a police officer in East Liverpool, Ohio, described how a powerful new opioid, fentanyl, had ravaged his town. Where are people getting fentanyl?
We are seeing it from higher drug kingpins, and most of our stuff is being shipped in from Cleveland and Columbus. Cleveland is about 2 hours north of us. Columbus is about 3 to 3.5 hours west of us.
If you were to ask me to bet, and I would probably bet my salary, that fentanyl came from China. I mean, it's that prevalent.
Wow.
So I'm Joseph Pinu. I'm the chief of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force at the United States Attorney's Office in Cleveland, Ohio. We're working, you know, hard with all of our law enforcement counterparts, FBI, DEA, HSI, Customs and Border Patrol. Believe it or not, the United States Post Office has police, and we're working, you know, almost every day hand in hand with them to identify the chemical companies in China to try to get the supply on that end shut off, because that's what's really most important. If you can shut down one of those companies, then you've really made a dent.
There's a pretty broad consensus that most of the fentanyl is now coming from illegal labs in Asia, and most particularly in China.
Nathaniel Popper is covering the opioid crisis for The Times.
You know, in China, you don't have an opioid crisis, you don't have an overdose crisis. And so a lot of these drugs and a lot of the kind of things you need to make the drugs are essentially legal there. And you have sort of educated, savvy people who can set up a chemistry lab and figure out ways to make this. In the course of my reporting, I communicated with one of the most popular dealers of fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, a guy who goes by the name, the screen name of Benzochems, who walked me through his process, who, you know, shared videos of his facilities in China where they're producing this stuff, and who also talked about how they're using the U.S. Postal Service, routing it through Hong Kong to get it to the buyers in the United States.
Wow, he takes videos of himself making these drugs?
He doesn't take videos of himself, but he does take videos of the sort of ramshackle beakers and tubes that they use to produce it.
You don't need a big dealer in Cleveland or Columbus or Cincinnati anymore. You can simply get on either the regular internet or the dark web from the comfort of your own home, order, you know, fentanyl or some analog of fentanyl like carfentanil or furanylfentanil, and have that delivered right to your house.
And what is the dark web?
You know, it's an interesting thing why that even exists. Like, some people say that the dark web is 90% of what the internet is, and the internet that we go on is probably only 10%.
Wow.
And you need a special browser to get there, but it has everything, A to Z. I liken it to kind of, I guess, the Wild West, where everything is available and it's, you know, complete lawlessness.
So if I log on to the dark web, I get this special browser, what am I going to see? What types of drugs am I going to see? Where are those drugs coming from? Who's selling them?
You can almost really see any drug that you really want to purchase. You could pretty much get on the dark web, put in a search of, you know, I want to buy fentanyl, and you'll get a listing of literally, you know, hundreds of chemical companies in China, some in India, some in Pakistan, that are willing to deal with you over the internet and send it to your door. Now, some of them are scams. Some of them are just going to take your money, but some of them are legitimate, and they're going to send the drugs right to your house.
Certainly, some people just thought that the dark web happened to provide this perfect technology for the spread of this drug fentanyl. You know, something like heroin, it's hard to sell it through the mail because you need so much of it to sustain a user. You know, it's bulky. And, you know, with fentanyl, a single first class envelope that, you know, you send your tax returns in could hold enough fentanyl to get something like 50,000 people high, or potentially even kill that many people.
That's incredible.
So the dark web sort of provides this perfect technology for the traffic in fentanyl that really doesn't work with other drugs as well. I also heard authorities tell me that it was really when you saw fentanyl being so easily available online that you also started to see the rising number of deaths, you know, attributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I mean, the reality is we're relatively early in this crisis. And I think the authorities are just trying to get a handle on the number of deaths. And it's another level yet to try to explain why it's happened in this way.
Yeah, I mean, in Akron, which is just a city a little south of Cleveland, within the last 2 months, we've had two toddlers overdose. One overdosed and died. I believe that one was 4 years old.
Wow.
The mother was using heroin mixed with fentanyl, had left it on the coffee table. I guess his poor little kid got into it. His 9-year-old brother called 911. 911 came, the paramedics, they revived him with Narcan, but then he died the next day.
Oh my gosh.
A pinch of this fentanyl, you know, this card fentanyl, a pinch of it, you know, is enough to kill you. So it's like, could there be a little bit more in one bag than there is another bag? You know, absolutely. So you just don't know. It is definitely a game of Russian roulette, for sure. My name's Josh Lytle. Started doing drugs when I was 12 years old. Just searching, just trying to find where I fit in this world, and led me down a road of a 12-year addiction. That led me to sticking needles in my arm, to being addicted to heroin and opiates and fentanyl.
Can you just describe to me, Josh, what it feels like to be high on fentanyl?
You just numb. Fentanyl has way more of a rush than just normal heroin. So if you make it through that rush, then, you know, you may be okay. If not, then, you know, there's trouble. But it's just at that point, it's too late once you push that plunger and it's in your arm.
Just physically, how is it possible for you to do a drug like fentanyl and survive?
Well, it just depends on what's in it. That's what I'm saying. Like, today, you don't really know what's in it. Like, I mean, it's so rampant. There's so many people shooting drugs so often. You know, I know our overdose rate is extremely high, but if you compare that to the number of people that are getting a high, you know, and doing it, it's like way more people shoot dope way more often than they do pass away. So you know that risk is there. You know it's very serious. You know that could be you. But at the same time, it's just like, I can't be sick. If I'm sick, I can't function. Like, I can't do anything.
Nothing else matters.
Right, nothing. It is the most miserable experience ever, you know, I mean, ever. Your skin, your hair hurts. I know that sounds crazy, but it literally, everything just hurts. You don't sleep. You can't eat. It's just, I was violently sick. It controlled my every move, what I said, what I did. I mean, literally controlled my life.
Did you feel like yourself at all? Did you feel like you still even had free will, or is it like something's inhabiting your body?
Yeah, I didn't feel like myself. I was miserable. Like, I wouldn't even look at myself in the mirror when I brushed my teeth because I hated the person that I was. Remember my cop that was in our school came to my house and knocked on the door, and when I opened up the door, he just got tears in his eyes and said, "Have you just looked at yourself lately?" And I hadn't, because I didn't want to face me, you know. And I remember I went and looked in the mirror that day and just broke down and bawled and cried. And but, you know, I still didn't see hope. I wasn't scared to death to die, but at the same time, I didn't want to experience life, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're obviously sober now. You help other addicts get better. So what changed? How were you able to get out of the situation you're describing, which sounds just unimaginably difficult?
You know, in 2005, I had a car wreck where I was never supposed to walk again because I shot dope and passed out behind the wheel. But, you know, I laid in that hospital bed for a year, and I would try to pray, you know, and I would just cry and say, man, I need a different life, God. I don't want to lay in this hospital bed. I had bigger plans than this for my life and not even be able to use a restroom on my own, you know, without help. And, you know, it literally a miracle happened. I mean, you know, one day I just said, man, this I'm going to do different. And I was still addicted because I was prescribed Oxycontin and Perc-10s. And
they prescribed you Oxycontin and Percocet knowing that you had these addictions?
Yeah.
You still got those prescriptions?
Yeah, sure did. I even made a comment one time to my mom. I said, I'm going to walk into this doctor. I'm going to come out with this. And she was like, "What? You're crazy." And I came out, and that's exactly the prescriptions that I had.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a legal way to say, "Get off my back, everyone. This is from the doctor." And so, yeah, I just had a legal way to get high, and insurance pretty much covered those prescriptions. So I didn't have to pay nothing, you know, and you learn to sell those and get heroin again.
Oh, my goodness.
It not only is a health crisis, it's a law enforcement crisis. It's a crisis of the desire to have these drugs and why so many people in our country are using these drugs. We far outpace any other, you know, civilized country in the world in terms of drug use. Part of the healthcare crisis, I think, you know, where you have to go back how this all started was the proliferation of prescription pills. Some of them a lot more addictive than either the pharmaceutical companies let on or some of the doctors were led to believe. Mm. You know, the fact that, you know, I'm 50 years old. When I had my wisdom teeth out, I got Tylenol. If you go get your wisdom teeth out today, there's a strong likelihood that you're going to come home with 25 Percocet or 25 Vicodin. And why do we need that? Why are we flooding ourselves with pills? For example, the United States makes up only 4.7% of the world's population. Yet we consume 99% of the world's production of hydrocodone, which is typically Vicodin.
Oh, my
gosh. There's a question, yeah. And you have to ask yourself, what is it about us that we're using drugs far outpacing any other, you know, civilized, industrialized country in the world?
You become numb to the situation because it is very demoralizing. It's like, We need help, you know, we need more men, we need treatment programs, you know, we need state and federal help, and just not getting it.
Which brings us back to Patrolman Chris Green.
I'm passionate about my hometown and take pride in it. And
so you're from East Liverpool?
Correct. You know, we do have our problems like anywhere else, but we want to see it succeed, you know. And being from this area, I have a lot of contacts with people that, you know, there's been many times where I've arrested my friends that happened to go down the wrong path and drugs, and I'm able to relate to these people and understand, you know, some of the hardships they're going through. And even when we arrest them, you know, sympathize with them and able to talk to them and kind of reason with them, like, man, you had everything, you know, you were a great wrestler, what happened to you? And sometimes they straighten up, get clean, and then sometimes they're just not ready, but just something about it just keeps me here and keeps me going. I mean, I love the city. It's just, we just need help, that's all.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about it.
Alrighty. If you need anything, call me.
Okay, take care. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Bye.
We came to East Liverpool, Ohio, because of a photo the town's police department shared on Facebook of two adults overdosed on heroin with a four-year-old sitting in the backseat of their car. Today, the woman in the photo has served her prison sentence and is out of jail, and the man has 2 months left. The four-year-old is living with relatives. Josh Lytle says they're getting better. Here's what else you need to know today. On Thursday afternoon, President Trump turned to Twitter to dispel a rumor that he started. "I have no idea," he tweeted, "whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings." Back in May, shortly after James Comey was fired as FBI director, the Times reported an account he'd given to a friend of President Trump inviting him to a private dinner and asking him for a pledge of loyalty. Trump responded at the time by saying Comey, quote, "better hope there are no tapes of their conversation." The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, and Andy Mills. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Special thanks to Martha Daniel, Peter Sale, Pedro Rosado, Doris Burke, and Michaela Bouchard. We'll be right back.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Caitlin Dickerson. See you Monday.